Hello, I'm Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their process and how they do their job. For this podcast, though, we're going to go a little bit off the board. Our guest is Jeff Schwartz. He is a NFL free agent lineman and the co-author with his brother Mitch of the book Eat My Schwartz, Our Story of NFL Football, Food, Family, and Faith. Mitchell Schwartz plays for the Kansas City Chiefs, so talking about two guys in one family, both made the NFL at the same position. Pretty cool story, and the two Schwartz brothers sort of explain how they ended up in the league, talk about their faith and family, their big cooks. Very much a fun read. I asked Jeff Schwartz about transitioning from playing to being in the media and why so many former coaches and former players seem to pull punches or hold back on their analysis.
I do think that an analyst shields their buddies. I mean, same as it would in a political show.
Right.
If you have a friend, you're not going to throw them under the bus. You want to use those sources to get information and to share the information, but you're not going to throw someone under the bus.
We'll also talk about how a professional athlete gets into the media and how one thinks about that during his or her playing career. We'll talk about the book and why Jeff wrote it and the process of writing something with a sibling, which must be interesting. Great line in that book that Jeff says when he and Mitchell arrived in the NFL, they instantly accounted for at least 20% of all Jewish players in the NFL. But in serious, I will ask Jeff about, he's very open about his religion on social media, and that's interesting to me. And I wonder if he's ever gotten any flack from that from either teams or Twitter users. That's in sort of an interesting part of who he is. So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. The guest is Jeff Schwartz, the co-author of the book, Eat My Schwartz. All right. And as promised, we bring in Jeff Schwartz, now a co-author as well as a free agent NFL lineman, perhaps potential broadcaster. Welcome, Jeff Schwartz, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me in today.
You got it. We'll get to the book in a second, and it's it's actually a pretty cool exercise to me that you wrote this with your younger brother, and I'm curious how you guys went about it in terms of if you wrote it separately, if you worked with a co-writer. But before that, one of the things that I find interesting about you, and I've been following you on Twitter for a while, is that it's very clear that you have an interest in media. Whether you do this after your athletic career is over full-time or not, I guess that remains to be seen. But you're someone, it feels like to me, very early in your athletic career, who started at least making inquiries into a sports media career after your playing career was over. So that's a long preamble by me to ask you, what's the genesis of that? At what point during your football career did you think, okay, when this is over, media might be something I want to do?
I really think it first started when I joined Twitter. I joined Twitter when I was hurt in 2011, and I started seeing the kind of knowledge being shared on Twitter, people sharing football knowledge, people talking about games. I started doing that. I love to talk. I love to share. I love to teach about football. So I just decided, hey, let's start tweeting. Let's start giving my opinion. I started doing a little bit more media in the cities I was in. And then, I kept kind of getting hurt, and I kept thinking about what I do when I was done playing football. And I just kind of came to me, hey, why don't I start working on a media career? And for a guy who's was under the radar for a while, and I'm not going to be in the Hall of Fame. I haven't won a Super Bowl yet. I was a good player when I was healthy. And so I just know I needed to start really early doing this. I'm not one of those guys that was going to retire and just walk right in to a studio show or, calling game or whatever it was. So, luckily, maybe I realized early on that I have to start as soon as possible to make this happen.
Jeff, when your playing career, you played for the Panthers for, I think, 3 or 4 seasons, the Vikings, the Chiefs, the Giants, and part of the Lions organization for a little bit. During all those organizations, do you have to actively tell the coaches or management that this is something you want to do and they should know that you're an active Twitter user, you're someone who shares your opinions, you're someone who talks about the game? What's the navigation in terms of being an active player, but also being proactive on social media?
That's a good question. So some teams have been great. The Giants were fantastic about it. They encourage their players to use the media, to get into the media. There's a lot of ex-Giants who are, you know, in broadcasting,
right,
calling games, you know, David Deal, you know, Sean O'Hare with NFL Network. And there's a lot of guys that have done it with the Giants. They were fantastic. You know, they checked on your Twitter. Hey, you know, don't tweet this maybe. Or if you had a tweet they didn't like, they let you know. Of course, they're going to check on it. I've been on one team who would kind of passively, aggressively told me that I shouldn't be tweeting so much. I asked them straight out, do you want me to stop tweeting? And it was kind of like, well, I don't know. Just tell me yes or no. So I think it's a little bit crazy to think that tweeting so much affects the way you prepare for a game. You can do both. I think I prepare really well for a game, but I also think I prepare well, you know, right now when I'm doing writing for SB Nation or tweeting about games or watching film. You know, you can do both at the same time.
Jeff, how do you reconcile being someone who's an individual who wants to offer opinions both in football and other subjects to the masses, yet you're working within a sport that, I'll be blunt, generally speaking, is not one towards individualism. It's towards collectivism. Team comes first. A lot of organizations are secret. So do you find that players have to, I don't even know how to sort of phrase it, do you have to sort of dial that back during your playing career? Can you only do it if you're a star where you have more leverage in the organization? But that's just interesting to me that as an individual, you should be allowed to sort of do and say whatever you want on your social media channels. Yet the league kind of seems to disencourage that kind of freedom of expression.
Well, I agree with you there. I mean, I think that when I was playing, I was very careful about what I tweeted about. I think it is important to make sure that while you're playing for a team, what you tweet about reflects on your team. So I would do a good job of not trying to cause a lot of controversy, trying to be smart. There were a lot of times I wrote tweets and just deleted them, never sent them. You know, if your employer wants you to act a certain way, then you kind of have to act that way or they're going to get rid of you. And I have no problem with that. I understand that. But now that I'm semi-retired, whatever you want to call it, I just tweet whatever I want. And I have no problem with that now. And if I go back to a team, then I'll dial it back to what's appropriate. I think it's important when you're a player and you're tweeting is to obviously not give away secrets. I mean, I think that's most important. So that's what I've done a good job about.
How often in the locker room did you find players talking about what other players would say on social media, whether something positive or something negative?
Almost never. I don't think anyone ever talked about tweets or Instagram. I mean, now a lot of guys would take pictures in the locker room intended for Instagram or Snapchat or Twitter. I mean, that happened, of course, but I don't think anyone ever really talked much about what guys were tweeting about unless it was something way over the top. I mean, I can't even recall one instance where someone talked about a tweet in the locker room.
It's actually amazing, Jeff, the amount of like locker room photos that happen that we haven't seen more nudity on Instagram. It's kind of amazing if you think about it.
Well, guys delete pictures really fast. Like there's been times where I've been in a locker room and a guy would have a video of someone dancing or someone doing something, and guys would make sure that to watch it before it gets put up to make sure there's no nudity.
Right.
We also aren't naked as much as people think we are. I mean, it might be something else too. Like it's not like a gym locker room where everyone just kind of walks around naked. Like it doesn't happen very often.
Right. It's not a nudist colony.
No.
Exactly. When I knew you were going, and we've been talking for a while, I knew I was going to have you on the podcast at a certain point. And this is a question that I've been waiting to ask you because I think it's just fascinating to me. I read a piece as we're taping this today. I think it's November 2nd, Al, November 1st, whatever it is. I read a piece on Politico where they talked about how politics and political coverage has so many people who are former campaign managers, campaign advisors, government officials, the David Axelrods, the Donna Brazils, the Corey Lewandowskis, etc. And this writer, and I think he's correct on this, was saying that ultimately these people are nothing more than paid partisans, and yeah, they can perform, and yeah, they do well, but they're not revealing anything to viewers that is the reality of what they know. They're not revealing secrets about one candidate or another, etc. That's my long preamble, Jeff, to get to sports. You're someone who played in the league for a while, and I think you'd be an educated consumer when it comes to watching pregame shows and watching NFL coverage. You can take this as long or however you want, but as a general rule, how much as viewers are we getting in terms of reality and truth from analysts on pregame shows?
That's a good question. You know, I think scheme wise, when they talk scheme, you're getting everything because there's no reason for an analyst to not tell the truth about that. I do think that an analyst shields their buddies. I mean, same as it would for, you know, for in a political show.
Right.
If you have a friend, you're not going to throw them under the bus. You want to use those sources to get information and to share the information, but you're not going to throw someone under the bus. I think you're getting, you know, a pretty good version of what happens. And now with all social media and everyone wants to see how the sausage is made, you get a lot more access to the locker room. And sometimes I think that backfires because you learn a little too much about how football is made. It's a different animal than almost anything else, different than a lot of other sports. And so I think you get a good amount of what really happens. I don't think any player will ever give you a 100% like access to how the locker room is, because it's just kind of our little fraternity. And I don't think you'll ever get anyone to give you everything that happens or everything we talk about, everything we do in the locker room to prepare every week. But you get a good portion of that on TV.
Jeff, what about the game in terms of game analysis from the Gruden types or the Collinsworth types and play-by-play? Do you feel like that viewers are being educated by them in terms of game stuff? Or, again, is there a little bit of a holdback because of relationships? You know, maybe there's an analyst who wants to get back in the game again as a coach, et cetera.
Well, I think there's always going to be a little bit of protecting your friends. But I think, like, John Gruden, I know people give him grief sometimes for being too positive, but I think he does a good job teaching the game. I think Collinsworth does a good job. You know, Collinsworth is always going to be partial to Pro Football Focus, right? That's what
he is
into. And
right.
he's one of the investors. So he's always going to, you know, be partial to their grading system. And that makes sense to me. And I still think he does a good job being partial all the way around. I think your job as an analyst is to give the why to what's happening, right? And I think those guys at the top do a really good job of that. Troy Aikman does a great job of that. Dan Fouts, all the, you know, analysts who've been doing it forever, they do a great job of giving you the why, so you feel informed as a listener. And I think it's important. I think I do this well, is when you talk about the game, you don't want to be too technical. There's a little bit of technicality that people want to know, but if you get like 100% into football, this is kind of what Mike Mayock does a little bit, and that's why I think maybe he got taken off of the Notre Dame games, is he's like so technical it overloads the listener to where they can't understand what's going on.
Yeah, I think you're – I mean, that is in fact the reason why. I think NBC's producers thought he was far too much into X's and O's and too much into jargon. I actually think that's fascinating. I think Mayock's great, but I understand where they were coming from in terms of if you're trying to find sort of the middle of the road viewer, maybe in that sense, less is more. I disagree with that, but I understand where they were coming from. Jeff, in terms of if you were going to go into television, does the studio environment appeal more to you, or does the game environment, and why?
So the only thing I've never done actually is do a game. I've done studio, radio, I write now. And actually, this will come out pretty soon on the weekend or somewhere around that. I'm going to call my first game this weekend, Division II game in California.
Oh, awesome.
So I'm actually really looking forward to that. That'll be something that's unique and I haven't done before. And that's what I really would want to do. I went to broadcast boot camp, and it's a kind of a joint venture that the PA and NFL put on, and you meet all the executives and you network, but you also learn about every facet of broadcasting. So we got to actually call the first quarter of the AFC Championship game between the Broncos and the Patriots as the analyst. And, you know, it's the first time doing it, and it wasn't the best, but I'm looking forward to doing that. That's what I would love to do, because then you're still kind of part of the game a little bit. You get to travel. You know, one thing is, you know, when we travel to these cities as players, we don't get to spend a lot of time in the city. It's kind of in and out. So it'd be nice to kind of go to the city. You're still kind of part of the game, but you get to enjoy a little bit more. And I think with what I do best as far as analyst, I think that would be great. Studio shows are fun. I mean, you know, everyone wants to do that, but there's only so many studio jobs.
For the Division II game, is that what network is calling that, or are you doing it for a digital entity? What's
It's going to be digital. It's for Humboldt State Division II. You know, I just need reps, and my agent was like, "You need to get reps." So I started calling people around, and I'm really excited. I think I'm doing a high school game Friday too.
Great,
and I'm preparing for it. And it's, you know, I prepare the same way I prepare when I played. So I got my program, my 2D. I'm ready to go. It's going to be it'd be fun. It'd be a lot of you know, I've wanted to do this forever.
One of the things in the book that you wrote with your brother Mitch, and again, as we said at the top, it's Eat My Schwartz, Our Story of NFL Football, Food, Family, and Faith. Jeff writes it with his younger brother, Mitchell, who's in the NFL right now, an offensive lineman for the Chiefs. And there's a section in there, sort of, Jeff, when you're talking about media coverage of the league when acts of criminality occur, and that the majority of the league, you know, are good guys, a lot of people married, and that's all true. I mean, there's no doubt that the majority of the players in the league are law-abiding citizens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that leads to my question of, I find when I watch particularly like pregame shows or even the NFL shows during the week, there's so many analysts who have a hard time dealing with topics such as domestic violence within that realm. Now, I wonder maybe the larger issue is you can't expect a former athlete or a former coach to be an expert on this or to not sort of give the standard protecting guys. But do you have any thoughts on that as to when you're watching why on certain issues it just feels like we get a lot of NFL speak or we get a lot of protecting organizations, particularly at least when I watch on domestic violence?
Well, I think you get the NFL speak because that's like the default setting in us, right? I mean, we don't know kind of how to answer a question. We just go back to the NFL speak because we've done it our whole lives. I mean, I think domestic violence is hard to talk about, and you know, I don't feel terribly prepared to really talk about that. And that might be the reason why some of these guys revert back to that NFL speak, as you say, because they're not prepared to give informed opinions on what's happening. I think that's what you're finding with guys. You know, as far as defending teams and stuff like that, I mean, I think it comes down to relationships again, like we talked earlier in the show, just trying not to call out, you know, certain people because it might be bad for your future employment. I mean, as far as sad as that sounds.
Right. I should have asked you this before, but in terms of the active player relationship with the media, you would define yourself as someone who had a good relationship with the media, willing to talk, enjoyed sort of the process. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay. What's always interesting to me, I covered this a long time ago for me, but I covered the Bills in the 90s. And one of the things that was always interesting to me was to see how certain players reacted to other players who had the reputation of being press friendly. If the player who was press friendly was a great player, and like on the Bills locker room, the late Kent Hall was their center, essentially a Hall of Fame center, an incredible guy, great with the press. Nobody was going to screw with Kent Hall. He's the most respected guy in the locker room. But I always wonder, Jeff, and you're a great guy to talk to as an NFLer, how do other players view players who are press friendly, and do you need to be a really good player where your teammates wouldn't give you any kind of problem with that?
Well, as an offensive lineman, I know the guys in the Giants were happy I was the one who talked all the time. I mean, you know, that took it off them, right?
Right, right.
And I think if you're going to get into the media afterwards, you have to kind of be friendly with them while you're doing it. And you can learn from them and vice versa. And I've always thought that if you're nice to the media, then they would probably be nicer to you when they write about you or talk about you. I mean, just
sure.
Kind of,
yeah.
Right?
Human,
that's kind
human
of human
nature. Yep.
So I think that, you know, in a market like New York, you almost have to be friendly with the media. I don't see any other way. There's so much media and everyone's looking for a story that if you're going to be a curmudgeon to them, they're going to kill you and it's not going to be good. So I feel like you have to at least be somewhat cordial. And in other places, in other smaller cities, you might be able to get away with it because there's not as many writers. They want to be nice to you. You know, I don't think that in big market medias, they necessarily want to be nice. They just want to get a story. It doesn't matter if it's nice or not. And, you know, in smaller markets, you can get away with that. But I've never found any backlash, you know, with my teammates. You know, Steve Weatherford was a teammate of mine for 2 years, and he did everything. He does everything. He still does everything. And no one, you know, really gave him any flack for that.
Jeff, you play for the Panthers for a number of years. Charlotte Observer's the big paper there. I'm sure they have television stations, et cetera. Same thing in Kansas City, basically one paper town. What is the difference, or what was the difference for you in terms of media coverage and dealing with the media in cities like Charlotte and Kansas City versus New York?
Well, you know, the guys in the smaller markets tend to be just a little bit nicer to you. They give you the benefit of the doubt. You know, they're not always looking for a story. They're not always competing with for a story, you know, and in New York, I'm sure it's in Boston, I'm sure it's in other big cities that they're competing for stories. So they have to find something to write all the time. And I'll give you an example of that. When in February, I was down to the Super Bowl in San Francisco, and I gave an interview to two New York Giants beat writers. I was still on the team at the time. It was right before they cut me, and they're asking about my brother, who was going to be a free agent. right tackle, and the Giants were looking at tackles as free agents. So they asked, they asked me about playing with my brother, and I was honest. I said, you know, we're siblings. We get disagreements. I love my brother, but, you know, we might not really play well next to each other. It wasn't that bad, I didn't think.
Right.
And one guy wrote a story crushing me, and one guy wrote a story that was kind of nice. I mean, that's what you kind of get in New York. You don't really get that anywhere else. They would probably write stories that were very positive about you in other cities.
Those New York bastards. Can't believe
it. I liked it there. But it was kind of eye-opening. I did kind of learn a lesson. I got released before I could really not talk to that person anymore.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm saying that. I'm just mocking myself because we are based in New York here.
Of course.
Across the street, we can see the Freedom Tower, in fact. All right. One more thing on this. You obviously had an agent. You talk about him in the book a lot, your football agent. But did you have to get or do you have a separate broadcast agent for potential jobs heading forward?
Yes, I do. I have a separate one. I think it's important for a guy in my position who needs to make connections, essentially. I mean, people know who I am, but it's hard to convince people to give me a chance, essentially, because I'm not a well-known name. You have to kind of work your way up, and I'm fine with working my way up. So I think it was important to get a broadcast agent and to set a plan. I'm very big into kind of planning, and this was going to be my last year no matter what, if I was on the roster or not. So I planned to have it. I wanted an agent to be able to, when the season was over, to kind of hit the ground running. I don't like to sit at home. I want to work. I want to keep moving. So that's kind of why I got the agent, was to start when the season was over and work my way into some sort of job. But it's kind of paying off now because I have a lot of free time and trying to find different ways to do more media, to get more practice. And just for a guy in my position, I think it was important to have somebody who could talk on my behalf.
Right. We've had agents on this podcast before, and obviously given the broadcasters and media people we've talked to, agents come up a lot. It's a pretty interesting part of the profession. So, Jeff, in this case, did you actively go out to pitch yourself to broadcast agents, or because obviously you're an NFL player, if you follow you on Twitter, it's pretty obvious you're interested in this stuff. Did someone approach you to say, hey, I think you can have a future in this business. I'd like to work with you and we can make some stuff happen for you?
It was mostly people contacted me. A couple of meetings I had were that. And then, friends in the media, I kind of asked around, hey, who's your agent? Do you like them? And that got a couple of meetings set up. And then ultimately the one I went with is a family friend, but she's at an excellent, firm. And I'm not worried about the family friend. People don't want to work sometimes with family friends. She's excellent. She's awesome. So that's how that came about. But it was kind of mixed half and half. I didn't really seek out people, but I kind of asked for friends to kind of set me up with their agents and see if it would work out.
Gotcha. Do you want to mention her name, or are you keeping her silent intentionally?
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. Debbie Spander at Wasserman. I'm not sure
any secret
about that.
All right, Debbie. Yeah, but I know Debbie Spander, and obviously yeah. Wass. So you're Team Wass. I am
Team Wass.
You have to put that hashtag in all your tweets now.
I have not done that. I know they kind of did a whole rebranding of right. social media for their no, but I'm very low on the Team Wass chart
on the landscape.
There's a lot of people way ahead of me.
Yeah, they got some Olympians, some gold medalists, I think, in fact.
Yeah, they have like an entire all-star NBA roster.
They do. But that's good, obviously big firm, and that will eventually help you. All right, let's finish up here, Jeff, on the book. Why the decision to write one? Is this something that you and Mitchell have been thinking about for a while? Like, hey, we're siblings in the same league. This is not so common, Rondé and Tiki, and I can name all the brothers in the NFL, but it's unique when two guys from the same family make the pros in any sport. So have you been thinking about this for a while, or did some either agent or publisher come up to you guys and say, we think this could be a fun book? A
couple of reasons. One, my agent, my football agent, is kind of always outside the box thinker, and that's why I like him, and he's always kind of worried about what you're going to do when you're done playing and all this stuff. So that kind of thought, and then coupled with our story, being the first Jewish brothers in the NFL since 1923,
wow.
And just kind of our unique path to the NFL, not a typical NFL family, I don't think, as you would think of the NFL, a stereotypical family of NFLers. So that kind of got the things rolling. My agent brought in somebody who kind of is, like we call her, our like project manager, and she ended up kind of getting the book going. And the goal really was to get our name out there, of course, but then eventually get a cooking show. So my brother and I both cook. It's a big part of the book. So we're working on that. That moves very slow than very fast. It's kind of a weird process. It's definitely different than any business I've ever been in, the TV business. It's something I'm learning about. But that's kind of where the genesis of the book started.
Yeah, I mean, the TV business is crazy because you don't know what hits, what doesn't hit, why something happens. I mean, it's a lot of smoke and bullshit, to be very honest with you. But if you get lucky, you could be famous and a billionaire. So that's why it's an interesting business. In terms of the process of writing, did you guys each sort of separately go into your own spaces and write? Did you write together? Did you each write with your co-author, Seth Kaufman? What was the process of making this book happen?
Yeah, so Seth did a lot of the work. Now, I talked to Seth on the phone, I don't know, 10 times. I mean, I have no idea. My dad and my parents were integral in giving stories. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. Like when I read the book for the first time, when I read over the first draft, like there were stories in there that obviously my dad or my mom had shared. I didn't even remember. And I was like, oh, okay, that's pretty awesome. Now I remember that. So my parents were a big help in that. But, you know, Seth would write something and my brother and I would look at it, we'd edit it, we'd change it how we wanted it. If it didn't sound like kind of our language, we would change it. And it just was that kind of process, keep sending drafts back and forth, cleaning up stories back and forth. And it took, I don't know, a year, maybe a year and a half to get everything kind of where we wanted it to be. And then we gave our okays and the publisher took over.
There's a part of this book where your teammate from Oregon, Jeff Kendall, I think I'm right about that first and last name. Okay, so I'm triggering my memory here. Where he said something to the effect of like somebody, I think either it was Jim Rome or some national radio host asked him, you know, about sort of being part of, I think it was a bowl game or something. He goes, we're just a bunch of fat kids living the dream.
Yes.
That got picked up all over the place. But if I remember right, eventually from that interview, you got reinvited onto the Jim Rome show. You had listened to Rome as a young guy. Was that your first national interview? Because you'd still be in college then, and obviously Rome is a national sports media figure whose stuff goes across the country, or had you been previewed or profiled in a bigger forum before that?
I think that was the first truly national. You know, recruiting services like those, like Scout and Rivals,
right,
and 247, like they just started up about the time I was being recruited. So there was a couple of those type of interviews, but nothing like Rome. And I listened to Rome my whole childhood, and Jeff Kendall did also. And eventually what happened was is we were really good that season, 2007, and our head coach, our running back, and our quarterback were on 3 straight weeks. And we told them to, hey, tell Rome that you have a couple clones listening to your show.
Right.
And they put on the offensive line. So Rome promised after the third guy said so that he'd have us on the next week if we won. So we win the game. We're in a conference room in our facility. It's me, Jeff Kendall, who's our backup center, and Max Unger, who's played 8 years in NFL now, is with the Saints. And we're sitting in the room. We're on the conference call. And it's going great. And then Jeff Kendall says, hey, I have something I want to say. And he pulls out 6 pieces of paper that he wrote. He hand wrote his little rant. And it was incredible. I was shocked. I didn't know he was doing it. He was like shaking because he was so nervous and fired up for it. And Jim Rome racked it. He played it on his end of year show. And that's where the Fat Kids Living a Dream came from. And my parents made shirts. I still have the shirt. They made shirts for the whole offensive line.
Nice.
And that's a cool part about playing offensive line. Like, it's such a family. And, you know, unless you've really played the position, it's hard to explain like what the mentality of the offensive line is. But it just was a great moment for our offensive line, our school. And it was just, you know, being 21 years old and being on Rome, being an offensive lineman, it was such a cool experience.
Am I right about this, that 2007 team, that's Chip Culley's first year as a offensive coordinator? And if you're talking about quarterbacks who went on, I guess that must have been Dennis Dixon, right? Was that the,
yeah,
am I right about that?
It was Mike Bilotti was our head coach, and then Jonathan Stewart, who's still in the NFL.
Oh, yeah,
and
right.
Then Dennis Dixon. That was the 3 guys that were on before us.
Nice. That's a pretty good team. Chip Kelly
good
is
memory.
Chip Kelly is a first year offensive coordinator. That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
All right, here's the final one I want to ask you. And it's pretty great. There's a line in this book where you say that when you and Mitch arrived in the league, you instantly accounted for at least 20% of all Jewish players in the NFL. I love that's like, I think that's my favorite line in the book. It's really funny. But one of the things that I like about this book, and I like about what you do also on your social media feed, is you have zero issues in celebrating your background, your religion. You'll tweet out Hanukkah photos, you have little kids, and like you're excited when they do something within their religion. That's not something we have always traditionally seen with athletes. I mean, you know, Fellowship of Christian Athletes for sure. But as a general rule, especially in the NFL, I don't see a lot of guys talking about what religion they are. And I thought that was pretty cool. And I wondered if part of that is that you want young Jewish boys and girls, particularly those who want to go into sports, to realize that there are Jewish athletes in the NFL. I think probably you think of them in Major League Baseball, which has been a lot of, obviously, Koufax, the most famous, Hank Greenberg, etc. But I wonder if that's part of your motivation, just because it's not a league you would necessarily associate with Jewish athletes.
Yeah, that line in the book is awesome. I had a trainer on one of my teams tell me that I should be owning the team, not playing for the team. That was funny too. He told me that like once a month. I think that it's important if we're going to be role models in the Jewish community. You know, we wrote the book. We talk about, you know, Judaism, that we share our lives as Jews. And I know a lot of people look up to my brother and I, you know, for being able to play football and be part of the faith. And I'm very proud of my son. He goes to, you know, the JCC, the local JCC, and it's awesome seeing him immersed in religion. And I think that it doesn't matter what religion you are, but I think religion provides a good firm, like, foundation in your moral compass and the way you kind of grow as a young kid and move up into an adult. So I think it's important to share some of those moments and memories, and I don't mind doing it. I've really gotten no flack for it. I know this time with the kind of the political era we're in right now, there's a lot of things going on Twitter and social media. And to be honest with you, I've gotten almost none of it, one or two times, and I just block the person and move on with my day.
That's great. Maybe that's a nice sort of note as we head forward, that at least there's some positive on that. That's a cute kid, though, too. It'd be really hard to crush him. He's a good-looking young kid. So
thank you.
All right. The book is Eat My Schwartz with Jeff and Mitch Schwartz with Seth Kaufman. It's their story of NFL food, family, and faith. These are two brothers who made the league, both at the same position. Mitch is obviously still playing. Jeff's a free agent. As he said, this would be his last year in the league regardless. And, you know, you're going to start to see him, I think, in different media outlets. Like he said, he's writing for SB Nation. He's doing some games this weekend. He's a great Twitter follow. I highly recommend him, and I think he's going to have a long career in this business. Jeff, we've been talking about this, it seems like, since 1920, so I'm really glad that you finally joined us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Thanks for the time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me in.
Back in the studio to wrap up, my thanks to Jeff Schwartz for coming on. Really enjoyed that conversation. Thanks to producer Alan Kim. Some podcasts that are already done that you can listen to include Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada and David Farenthold, the fine reporter and writer for the Washington Post. My thanks to all the Sports Illustrated people who are part of the podcast team here, including Alan Kim, Ben Eagle, Ryan Hunt, Bette Marston, everyone else is part of the Sports Illustrated podcast team. Thanks to Digital Media. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.